Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. My name is Jordan Fennell. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, stepping in for Aggie Tupou this morning. Today on the show, Pacific leaders say the postponement of a landmark deal to cut shipping emissions is disappointing.
You know, we were expecting it to be passed at this session that just gone last week. But unfortunately, the US government in particular mounted a very strong campaign threatening countries.
I'll also take you down into Fiji's deep waters with the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition.
It's very likely that some of the animals that we're going to see on there will be the first records of that species in the country of Fiji.
And ahead of the COP30 UN climate change talks starting next month, I'll be joined this morning by Solomon Islands climate negotiator to talk about what the game plan is. Those stories and more this morning on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, Pacific leaders are unhappy after what was supposed to be a landmark deal to cut global shipping emissions has now been left in tatters. Back in April, the members of the International Maritime Organization agreed to place a small levy on the shipping industry's carbon emissions. But supporters have accused the United States government of intimidating members at a meeting in London to approve the plan, and it's now on hold for a year. Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change Adaptation, Ralph Reganvanu, says it's a disappointing outcome.
Well, it's very sad, actually. I mean, this process has taken years. The Pacific has been at the forefront of efforts to push this industry-wide measure, which would have been the first ever industry-wide measure to address global greenhouse gas emissions from a sector, a particular sector, in this case, shipping. And you know, we were expecting it to be passed at this session that just gone last week. But unfortunately, the US government in particular mounted a very strong campaign threatening countries not to adopt it.
You've said before that the deal already wasn't strong enough to align with the 1.5 degree target. How does this latest setback affect that goal for small island nations like Vanuatu?
Well, earlier we were, at the beginning of this year, we made the point that the measure being proposed, the IMO, was totally inadequate to address and meet the 1.5 goal, but also the financing goal that the Pacific had originally proposed. But nevertheless, you know, any sort of measure industry-wide could have been worked on and improved. And so we were very much coming from a position of already being compromised, but still coming to support a step in the right direction. So the fact that this step in the right direction didn't even happen is a very grim reflection on the current state of multilateralism. And so not seeing this measure go through is unfortunately seems like a trend in the last 24 months, or at least since Trump took power, of all climate commitments being rolled back across the world.
The shipping levy was expected to generate climate finance revenue that could help vulnerable countries. What does its collapse mean for funding adaptation and loss and damage efforts in the Pacific?
There's already a huge climate finance gap. What countries promised to do, what the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, states should happen, what is agreed in Paris. There's a huge billions and billions of dollars in a gap between what's required and what's been put up.
Vanuatu has been leading global and diplomatic efforts, including the ICJ climate advisory opinion. How does the shipping deal episode reinforce your push for stronger international accountability?
It didn't really reinforce our push. It sort of showed how far we are from international cooperation in a way that complies with international law on issues of climate change. So I think for us, it just reinforces now that we need to start talking about the rules of how we engage in these spaces as states. How do we meet in these forums to make decisions? How are decisions made? Because in the IMO, for example, what happened last week, we came from the Pacific expecting there to be a level playing field where science and legal accountability are given equal hearing to issues of economic achievement and so on. But what we found was that it was very difficult to operate in this environment where single states or groups of states can block a majority from making a decision. And we've seen this in the COPs year after year, the UNFCCC COPs. We saw it with the Plastics Treaty. We've just seen it again with the IMO. And so something's got to change in terms of the rules of how we engage in this space as states.
Given this setback, do you think the Pacific needs to look at alternative strategies, perhaps regional shipping reforms or carbon pricing that don't rely on a global consensus?
Well, we are already. We are doing work on regional shipping. We are working on regional solutions. Our leaders just launched the Pacific Resilience Facility in Solomon Islands at the Pacific Island Leaders Forum Leaders Summit in September last month. There are all sorts of regional efforts going on. We're also engaged in a number of other international efforts like the push for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. We're engaging in the Powering Past Coalition, the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, numerous other international groupings of states that want to make a change, that are willing to engage in this pathway of actually dealing with this crisis we're facing. And also in the region, of course, we are doing all efforts we can to engage regionally. So yeah, that stuff is ongoing. We're not waiting for the big organizations like IMO or so on to shift, but of course they also have to shift. We can't do it simply at the regional level.
What message would you like to send to the United States and others who have stalled this deal, especially as Pacific nations continue to face rising seas and intensifying climate impacts?
Well, it's the message I've stated previously is that climate change is affecting the United States of America. We've just seen the massive flooding in Alaska, the massive evacuations. Earlier this year, we saw the floods in Texas, the loss of lives, and we just continue to see all of these climate effects affecting all nations in the world, including the US. And so we are simply making the call on behalf of us all, and whether you like it or not, whether you think it's real or not, it's coming for you. And the sooner we get to a global solution, the sooner we can start to avert the worst possible effects of climate change.
That was Ralph Reginvanu, Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change, Adaptation, Energy, Environment and Disaster Management. Now, the deepest parts of Fiji's ocean were seen for the first time during a recent National Geographic Pristine Seas expedition. The mission brought together Fijian and international scientists to study the never-before-seen deep ocean and collect data to guide the country's marine management plans. Among those who went to the bottom of the sea was Fiji reporter Lithe Mavono.
Fiji is a nation born of the sea. There is a part of its ocean most have never seen. In January, the government signed an agreement with National Geographic's Pristine Seas to explore and help protect its offshore deep waters. And for me, it was the ride of a lifetime.
Thank you for bringing us.
The night before our submarine dive, I felt anxiety and fear, but I knew I was making history.
The first Itoke woman
and the first Pacific journalist to go this deep in this submersible. Looking up, the sky and sun beamed through the water. Through the clear dome, it felt like a fishbowl. 10 minutes later, I looked down, and we were already 20 meters deep. The blues shifted into something entirely new.
Oh my gosh, I'm never going to get over this.
The fear lifted. I couldn't stop smiling. It was like another world.
I just want Fijian girls, Pacific Island girls, to look at this.
Scientists call it the offshore deep sea. For Fiji, like most Pacific nations, it's a blank space. We know the beaches and reefs, but beyond the horizon lies the next frontier. Unknown, invisible, yet vital.
It's very likely that some of the animals that we're going to see on there will be the first records of that species in the country of Fiji.
To capture the deep, scientists used new tools, submersible dives, drop cameras reaching 6,000 meters, bravs to lure sharks and rays, even eDNA samples to detect life from a single drop of water. The results were extraordinary. Tiger sharks, manta rays, humpback whales, turtles, giant clams, even spawning fish aggregations. Some species were recorded here for the first time.
Of all the deep sea, when you put together the actual area that has been seen by human eyes, it's only 0.001% of the seafloor.
For Fiji, the goal is clear: to protect 30% of its ocean by 2030. But protection is only meaningful if you know what's there. Until now, deep sea data was almost impossible for Pacific governments to get.
When we say we are going to protect this area, what are we really saving? So this research will give us some information and data and, you know, help with the discussions that's taking place in terms of, you know, what's out there, what are we trying to protect, and how is this going to benefit.
Welcome back!
In 3 months, the Argo and Argonaut took 15 Fijians into the deep. Politicians, scientists, teachers. The idea, if they experienced the awe, they would carry that urgency into policy and classrooms.
Without that sense of awe and wonder, we would not love the ocean. It's the sense of awe and wonder that makes us fall in love with nature and the ocean and makes us want to preserve it.
But scientists warn, overfishing and extraction risk wiping out species before we even know they exist. When we finally reached the bottom, I was overwhelmed. The deep sea is often romanticized, but what I saw beneath the waves were homes, living beings in their own worlds.
When you get to the bottom of the ocean, you just feel with so much awe. For me, it was awe for the creator and awe for this entire ecosystem that exists at the bottom of the ocean that you think you know about, and I thought I knew about. I've been working in this space for a while, but it doesn't prepare you for the magic that you feel when you realize you're not alone, but you are the one that has the most impact on everyone else, and that's a responsibility.
An incredible journey there that Lithe Mavono, Fiji reporter, got to go on. And you can, of course, also catch the TV version of that story online at ABC Pacific or ABC iView. Incredible story there from Lithe Mavono. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Now, the name Paul Yawiga is not one that many people would recognize, but a Papua New Guinean documentary maker is hoping to change that. When World War II reached Rabaul in 1942, Paul Yawiga joined the Allied forces as a coast watcher, helping to report on enemy position and movements across what was then New Guinea. His story is now being turned into a film by Ezekiel Harau, who, like Yawigal, is also from East Sepik Province. Mr. Harau says too many PNG war heroes have died and their stories have been lost with them. And Ezekiel Harau spoke to our reporter, Hilda Wayne.
I went back home back in 2014. I reside in Port Moresby, but I went back home and I went to his village and saw his graveyard, and I asked his friend if they got any help from the government, or did the PNG government help them for the services gave to us. And they said no. So, that prompted me to ask myself, how can I help them, and how can I get this story out so that people can see and government can see and do something for them. Paul Yawiga has done a lot of things for us when he came back from war. He built a lot of things, and that I decided to do something and get a story out. While National Students Union, they asked me to go and do the documentary back in 2023. I went and I got just a brief of what Paul Yawiga did during the war that came to us in 1942.
And when you were researching and talking to the villagers and asking questions about his life and so on, what did you find out about Paul Yawiga?
His people back home, they saw him as a someone where big men are, a chief or something back in the village. And, after what he did, they saw him as a leader. When I got the story from these people, they told me about the great things he did, the services he brought. These are things I thought a lot of us should know about, especially the future generation should know about his story and his contribution.
Before bringing services to his village and his community, he fought in the war with the Australian Army. What did you find out about Paul Yawiga's involvement in the war, World War II?
His story is a quite complicated one. He was in the village and he went up to the houseman where, a lot of young men would go and go into initiation to become a man. So he went and he failed. And so he took off to Rabaul. That was in the 1930s. And when he went there, he went and worked in one of the plantations in Rabaul. And when the word came that the Germans were hiring natives to work in the native police force back then, so he went and joined the native police force. And so when the war came, he went he joined the Allied forces and served alongside them. That was what they told about his story. He was with the U.S. Army, actually, and he served as a post watcher.
And when you were researching his work, have there been any other World War II hero from Papua New Guinea that whose stories have been written or documented in your research?
I think this would be the first one in our province, in ECP. There are other war heroes as well, but this is the first one that we're going to do. And so I want this to be a really good documentary so that other war heroes, like people can see and do other documentaries for other war heroes in PNG.
What kind of help do you need to try to document history, and especially getting history from the Australian side of the war?
The things that he did while he was on the battlefield, fighting with the Allied forces, and when he got injured, I think, in my opinion, I think he should be compensated more for what he did. So when he came back, he was illiterate and speak English and writing English. And so most of the things that he did was not documented. There was a Catholic bishop by the name of Leo Upfield. He wrote something about Yawiga, but more information about him was memorial archives. I think they might help us with some of the stories of Paul Yawiga we should get more stories from them so that we can do a cross-check from what we're getting from the people here. So we have to confirm with the Australian side of the story. So that's what I'm doing, and I hope they can help us with that, give us some information about Paul Yelga. I need more equipment to shoot this documentary because I want this to be, like a high-quality documentary that's going to set the precedence here. So I need more equipment, especially with audio and the cameras. I have my equipment, but they're not enough. So I need some more equipment to help shoot the documentary. So I'm seeking help from the government, and also if the Australian government can help with that, that would really help me to complete the documentary.
That was PNG documentary maker Ezekiel Harau speaking there with Hilda Wayne.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Sosse Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell with you here on this Tuesday morning. Now, next month, Pacific Island nations will travel to Brazil for the United Nations COP30 climate change talks. But this month, climate change negotiators from around the region gathered in Samoa to finalize their strategy and game plan heading into those talks. And one of those negotiators is Melissa Horoku from Solomon Islands, and she joins me here this morning. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you joining the program this morning. Melissa, you have described adaptation as a matter of survival for Pacific communities. When you went into these game plan talks in Samoa, how did that look? What were you talking about? And how is that going to be translated into a game plan for COP30?
Adaptation has always been a matter of survival for the Pacific Islands. It has always been a priority for us as well. We've done adaptation at our own national level, and we're planning on doing it regionally. That's something we've been doing for years. But when it comes to the discussions at a UN level, there seem to be a mismatch about the discussions and what's been happening down and in our communities and our nations. So I think the first step forward would be to identify agenda items that we can discuss this adaptation agenda is under. I think that has been that is a way forward. Going into this climate talks in the next coming month, and hoping to see results. Yeah, when it comes to adaptation.
When you were at those strategy meetings in Samoa, what were the main outcomes that you talked about that are going to feed directly into the game plan for COP30?
I think the new one that we've just had this year is the ICJAO. That is an interesting one. That, yeah, I think we when we talked about it in Samoa, we kind of affirmed that it is timely that came out. It has been years since anyone has ever pushed for that. And so that's an outcome that we kind of agreed on. Not kind of, we agreed on. We also have agreed on priority areas under each thematic areas that we want to see results in heading into COP. In terms of strategies, there is agreement between parties when it comes to pieces. on priority areas that we see fit for pieces to pursue. It is a priority area for us as SIDS. And so there is an understanding. I'm not going to talk about what they are, but yeah, between the pieces on going forward, having common voice and all that is something that we agreed on going into the COP30.
And how important is it to have, because at these talks there were negotiators from all across the region that were getting together get on, I guess, one level, one page heading into the talks in Brazil. How important is it for all the different Pacific negotiators to come together and say, this is what we're going to all push for, sort of as a block?
That is a very important way of getting matters across the line, as opposed to having one party pushing for it. Having collective voice on it is very important. It also shows solidarity when it comes to meetings like this, discussions like this. It shows that, yeah, we are affected by similar issues. This is what we want. It's not an individual push. It's something that's coming from a collective group. It kind of echoes, it goes far. It's just not saying something here and then having it just stay here, but it goes far into other rooms. I think that's one of the most important things of getting priorities across all rooms is having a collective voice on it. Yeah.
Now, the COP UN climate change talks have been going on for about 30 years now. At the beginning, when Pacific countries were turning up, there were very, very small delegations. Across the years now, those government delegations have built and built and built. But of course, it takes a long, you know, people have to travel more than 24 hours sometimes. Getting from the Pacific to Brazil can take a long time. There's often little sleep for people involved. Can you take me behind the scenes for yourself as a Pacific climate negotiator? What it's like to be at these COP meetings? What does a day-to-day look like for you?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I think we haven't been asking ourselves that for years. We had our assumptions, but going into these meetings, the travels, yeah, those are hideous and tedious as well. But the meetings itself on a day in the life of a negotiator, that's something else compared to the travels. It's like, first, we have to understand that these delegations go with a whole team. We're under-resourced. We don't have the whole team that we need to cover all the areas that we want. So a minimum of, you know, an individual negotiator could cover for a minimum would be three thematic areas. And under these three thematic areas, you have agenda items. And then you have a workload of following these items, producing the briefs, the coordination, everything else. So in a day, you probably have, in a good day, you'll have 5 hours of sleep. On a bad day, you don't have sleep at all, or two hours of sleep. It's crazy.
That does indeed sound crazy. And what does it, I guess, what are the challenges that you come up against as well? So if it's just you, you're a climate negotiator, like you say, you have all these different briefs, all these sub-briefs as well to deal with, little sleep. What other challenges are you coming up against when you have to go toe-to-toe, back and forth with other countries to try and get things across the line at these COP talks?
So they come with their priorities, their expectations, they come with their game plans. And I think when you're under pressure, one of the things that it's very important that you do is you listen. You listen to what they have to say. And there are days in which you just feel like, I cannot listen to anybody. This is just, I'm tired. We might as well push this and that. But then, yeah, you have to listen and you have to make decisions on the floor as everything changes with time, and as the meetings happen, things change, people change how the tactics change, they change their stories, but the whole aim remains the same. So listening is important. That's a challenge for me, I'd say.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very dynamic situation when you're doing that high pressure, I guess, and intense. I want to bring it back to adaptation being one of the things at the forefront for you in particular when it comes to going to COP30 next month. In terms of adaptation priorities for Pacific countries, what themes are you going to be putting in place front and center at these talks next month?
I'm going to speak on behalf, I think, in my national capacity, I'd say when it comes to adaptation, parties make pledges in these meetings, and they don't deliver on these pledges. when it comes to climate finance, we're like way back. It's not showing. So finalizing the indicators would be a priority. But for us to see where the money is going when it comes to adaptation, are we actually delivering on it or not? It's going to support whether these claims of, oh, this, we deliver, we get the finances across or not. So this GGA framework would probably will help us determine if that's true or not. Yeah.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining us here this morning on Pacific Beat, giving us a behind the scenes on what happens at COP and, of course, what you've got front of mind going into those talks next month. It's been great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
That was Solomon Islands climate negotiator Melissa Horoku speaking to me there. Now, it's been almost 40 years since the Marshall Islands entered into a compact of free association with the United States. Under COFA, Marshallese people gained the right to live and work freely in the U.S. in exchange for the U.S. having exclusive military access and control over key parts of their islands. And in the last four decades, thousands of Marshallese have migrated to the U.S. seeking work, healthcare, and education. But has this been a good deal for the Marshallese people? To find out, I spoke with Colgate University Assistant Geography Professor Emily Mitchell-Eaton, who is also the author of Migration as Decolonization, The Politics of Free Association in the Pacific. And she took me back to where it all began to explain how COFA came to be and how it's evolved over the last 40 years.
The Compact of Free Association, or COFA for short, is actually three separate international agreements, or compacts. And these COFA agreements were established in the mid-1980s between the United States and three Pacific Island nations, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau, all of which were former U.S. territories. So the compacts were established or elaborated at the time at which these former territories or colonies were becoming independent countries. So these compacts granted the U.S. strategic control over these nations' security and defense in exchange for economic and assistance and benefits for their citizens. And so my book focuses specifically on the compact between the U.S. and the Republic of the Marshall Islands, or the RMI. These compacts are incredibly broad-reaching agreements that lay out the terms of the political, economic, diplomatic relationships between the two countries. In that way, they serve as kind of a bilateral international agreements, but they can also be understood as post-colonial or even neo-colonial policies, more like treaties between unequal parties. So two crucial features of the compacts that I focus on in my research are, one, that they ensure U.S. strategic exclusive military access to the Pacific Islands and the waters, ocean waters surrounding them, and two, that they allow visa-free migration or the right to move to, live, and work in, and study in the United States for citizens of those countries. Right. So that's an incredibly rare immigration provision that doesn't exist in a lot of other places in U.S. immigration law. And of course, that is a policy that sort of, if not created, really sort of cemented the creation or the growth of the Marshallese diaspora, immigrants outside of moving outside of the Marshall Islands to places in the U.S. Mainland. So the compacts, just to reiterate, the compacts really tie together migration and U.S. military access in a distinctly imperial fashion.
Do you know at the time how it was viewed from the Marshall Islands perspective? Like, was it considered a great deal, or was it sort of like, we're just going to have to see this because we're coming out of the old U.S.-administered trust territory after World War II? Do you know what sort of that feeling was when that transition was happening?
So there are lots of different feelings across the island. So we're talking about a region, the trust territory that included what became a region that became three separate independent countries, right, with a range of different stakeholder positions and interests. And we're talking about compact negotiations that took place over nearly 20 years, right, and then continued on after 1986. And so there were elections that took place, plebiscite within the islands, and the compact did gain a majority of support among those who voted. But there also was, it's important to be said, a great deal of concern over the degree of autonomy that the island nations would have over certain areas of their governance, as well as the degree of influence the U.S. military would continue to have in the islands, including in places like and the places in the Marshall Islands that had been under nuclear testing, or places like Kwajalein that still hosted the ballistic missile site.
And what, when this was happening, what did the United States want from the compact, and what did Micronesian leaders believe they were getting in return? I guess key top line points of that.
Mm-hmm. So for U.S. negotiators, and I interviewed many of them for my book, retaining exclusive military access to the islands was key, right? So the Pacific was seen then, and still is now, as kind of a crucial linchpin of the expanding U.S. global military base empire, right? And so retaining, the ability to exclude other geopolitical powers at certain points, Russia, at other points, China or Japan, from entering into that region of the Pacific was seen as really critical for the U.S. negotiators and for the U.S. side. Now, for the Micronesian negotiators, and I'm using Micronesia to refer broadly to that region of the Pacific, but that includes also the Republic of the Marshall Islands, the most important was the retention of unrestricted migration to the U.S. So bear in mind that the Marshall Islands had been, in 1986, under U.S. colonial administration for 40 years and had been enjoying fairly free or unfettered migration to the United States for the purposes of attending college, seeking employment, in many instances returning to the islands. And so that was a migration stream that had, or sort of phenomenon that had been taking place for many years. And it was really crucial for islandside negotiators to retain that. And they fought very hard to retain that part, that feature in the compact, both in 1986 and then in subsequent negotiations of the compact in 2004 and most recently in 2022.
And I guess with those sort of renegotiations that have been going on, do you think that both sides still see this deal that was signed, the agreement that was signed with COFA, in the same way today as they did back then? If the US still sees it as that sort of like, we need the presence, the military presence, we need to keep other geopolitical actors out, and that the Micronesian side still sees it as like, we want access to be able to live and work in the States, essentially.
In some ways, yes. I think each of those issues, right, the exclusive military access for the U.S. and migration access for the Micronesian and Marshallese side, continues to be very important. Keep in mind, however, that we're talking about a series of negotiations, right, and renegotiations that have taken place over 40 years now. And so each time that the negotiating parties come back to the table, which is a provision that's baked into the compact, they'll be sort of regularly renegotiated. They're doing so, and the negotiators are coming to the table under a political landscape that has shifted. So one great example of this is that in the negotiations in the early 2000s, negotiators were dealing with sort of a post 9/11 geopolitical landscape. Part of what characterized that landscape was the intensified hardening and militarization of U.S. borders, not just the borders that we tend to think of, the U.S.-Mexico border, for example, or the borders of the U.S., continental U.S., but also the U.S.'s borders in the Pacific, in places like Guam, Saipan, and in its partnerships with the freely associated states, or the COFA states, like the Marshall Islands. And so there was an increasing concern at that time among islandside negotiators that right of migration would be kind of yanked away because of that political climate around immigration. Now, part of what I mean to say when I highlight that is that these provisions, for example, protections of migration, the right to migrate, are struggled for and hard won. None of them have been freebies from the U.S. government, and none of them are sort of shored up in perpetuity. They have to continually be renegotiated for. Of course, now we're seeing ourselves in the United States in a similarly an intensified anti-immigrant kind of moment politically, and there are again concerns among COFA migrants and COFA communities about what kinds of protections migrants might continue to enjoy or might fear that they might lose.
So I guess when I was researching it, obviously one of the lines that comes up when it's just generally summarized with COFA is that, yes, it just gives people the right to live and work in the States if you come from, say, Marshall Islands or Micronesia. But that's not what you're saying there is. It's not a given that that is just going to be always on the table, essentially, when it comes to a COFA renewal of the agreement. That could technically get taken away if it doesn't work out in negotiations at another point in time.
And one thing I think that's really important to emphasize there is that We are talking about negotiations between two countries that have a sort of a David and Goliath-like relationship. It's an incredibly unequal political relationship. So one member of this so-called partnership was a rising imperial superpower after World War II with a growing economic, political, and military influence of the U.S. and global footprint. And the other was its former colony, right? An island nation, in this case, three different island nations that had no standing military, had largely been sort of operating in a subsistence economy to date, and had undergone massive U.S. nuclear testing following the end of World War II, right? The U.S. detonated 67 nuclear tests and bombs in the Marshall Islands over a number of years. And so, to sort of depict the compact as a bilateral agreement between two equal partners is somewhat disingenuous or sort of untrue to the nature of that political relationship. At the same time, when I say that the compacts are imperial or colonial agreements, I don't mean in any way to diminish the political agency and savvy of Micronesian and Marshallese negotiators and civil society actors, right? These are people who worked very carefully over many, many years and decades in some instances to elaborate a compact that would reflect a more just relationship with the United States, their former colonizer, right? So, you know, any provisions in the compact that benefit Marshall Islanders, whether in the islands or in the diaspora, it's important to remember they're present there because they were struggled for, often under conditions of extreme political pressure and in some instances, subterfuge.
That was Colgate University Assistant Geography Professor Emily Mitchell-Eaton speaking to me there.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning here on ABC Radio Australia. And turning to some sports news now, because after 7 years in the international wilderness, Niue's rugby league team has returned in style, thrashing Japan in their own backyard by 58-8. But although it was a match played between two national sides, it was not officially sanctioned for reasons that remain shrouded in some mystery. Now, the hope is that mystery will be solved in time for Niue's next encounter, which has already been arranged for next month. Reflecting on the win over Japan, assistant coach Brendan Perenara says there was some nervousness in the camp before kickoff, and with very little time to prepare, he was surprised at how well the team performed.
For this tour, we had a mixture of players come from New Zealand, Brisbane, Sydney, and we had a couple of boys coming from Niue Island itself. They only play in the comp once a month, and the government has funded them too to come over.
And I noticed in the squad the name Perenara appears more than once. Are you all connected? I think there are three Perenaras in the team. Did I have that right?
Yeah, for sure. Corey Lee Perenara is my son, and MJ Perenara is my nephew, and Jazaz. They play at a good level. Two of them are still at school, MJ and Jazaz. Jazaz has just signed up for Broncos.
That says two things, doesn't it? One, clearly he's got great talent, and secondly, it bodes well for the future of the team if you have players of that age being sought after by a club like that, the current NRL Premiers.
Yeah, for sure. The generation playing in Japan is probably the next generation and the last generation. They fit in the criteria. A lot of the team that we took on tour, they were in the same category because all their grandmothers has been born in Niue.
After such a comprehensive victory, you've waited 7 years for this game. The question is, where do you go next? Is there another game in the pipeline? And is the International Rugby League doing anything to help you find a game?
Actually, Richard, we've found a game already. South Africa approached us and we'll be playing in another 2 weeks when we get back to Sydney at St. Mary's Stadium. So this is a big game going in from Japan, going in to play South Africa before they play the Collins qualifier. And hopefully we can get a green light to lift our status there.
So you've played Japan and beaten them comprehensively. You have the game against South Africa, who, if memory serves, when you played them, 7, 8 years ago, you beat them. Were you to beat them again this time, it would rather make a point point, wouldn't it? Bearing in mind that South Africa are competing for a place in the World Cup. And now we learn that Japan will be lining up with Philippines, Hong Kong and Singapore in their own Asian Championship. Meanwhile, New Ireland left high and dry.
Yeah, I don't know where to go from here. It's up to the main island. If they can give us the green light to lift our status internationally, we can climb the rankings. But till then, yeah, we're pretty much playing for each other and the people.
Have you asked the question as to why, for example, the game you played against Japan is not officially sanctioned?
I don't even know if there's a board. They're telling me that New South Wales have signed up with Niue and then Auckland. I don't know who's the boss, but the three of them got together and they said they don't want the sanction. I don't know why we've spent all this money and we've asked them to give us the green light to the International Rugby League or Asia Pacific Rugby League. Jeremy Edwards is the manager there. All he needs is the association to say, yes, this is a sanction international.
So does that mean that there is a, as it were, a rival camp who are looking to field a new AN team at some stage? Is that part of their plan?
Oh, I'm not too sure. They can't even get a team together, mate.
And what about the game against South Africa? Will that be sanctioned?
Yeah, I hope so. We're going to write an email and see if they can be sanctioned also.
It would seem slightly curious if it wasn't, if South Africa are playing what effectively for them would be a warm-up prior to playing the Cooks in that Rugby League World Cup playoff.
Yeah, because Cook Island would rather it be sanctioned too. Going into a qualification for the World Cup, they'll definitely want it to be sanctioned because I think they approached us because we're the closest to one of the international islands that can give them a good run. As we gave a good run for Lebanon when they asked us, they approached us because of that. And look what they've done in the World Cup after that. So I think we'll just have to sit down at the table and talk to Niue itself and hopefully we can sort something out to lift the status and we can play these internationals and go up the rankings.
Brendan Perinata, the assistant coach for the Niuean Rugby League team, talking to Richard Jewett about their successful international comeback. And the next chapter against South Africa will be written in Sydney next month. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, though, at 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Thank you so much for your company this morning. Stay tuned, though, to ABC Radio Australia because news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daly.